that garden grown, spun thread and wove the cloth we wore, hunted and found and rendered the meager ditch-side herbs to protect and guarantee what Spartan compromise we dared or had the time to make with illness, harried and nagged that Jones into working the corn and cutting the wood which was to be our winter's warmth and sustenance. The three of us, three women, I drafted by circumstance at too soon an age into a pinch-penny housewifery which might have existed just as well upon a lighthouse rock, which had not even taught me how to cultivate a bed of flowers, let alone a kitchen garden, which had taught me to look upon fuel and meat as something appearing by its own volition in a wood-box or on a pantry shelf. Judith, created by circumstance, 100 years of careful nurturing, perhaps not by blood, not even Coldfield blood, but certainly by the tradition in which Thomas Sutpen's ruthless will had carved a niche, to pass through the soft, insulated, and unscathed cocoon stages. Bud, served prolific queen, then potent and soft-handed matriarch of old ages serene and well-lived content. Judith, handicapped by what in me was a few years' ignorance, but which in her was 10 generations of iron prohibition, who had not learned that first principle of penury which is to scrimp and save for the sake of scrimping and saving, who, and abetted by Clytie, would cook twice what we could eat and 3 times what we could afford and give it to anyone, any stranger in a land already beginning to fill with straggling soldiers who stopped and asked for it. And, but not least, Clytie. Clytie, not inept, anything but inept, perverse, inscrutable, and paradox, free yet incapable of freedom, who had never once called herself a slave, holding fidelity to none like the indolent and solitary wolf or bear, yes, wild, half-untamed black, half-Sutpen blood, and if untamed be synonymous with wild, then Sutpen is the silent, unsleeping viciousness of the tamer's lash, whose false seeming holds it docile to fear's hand, but which is not, which if this be fidelity, fidelity only to the prime fixed principle of its own savageness. Clytie, who in the very pigmentation of her flesh represented that debacle which had brought Judith and me to what we were, and which had made of her, Clytie, that which she declined to be just as she had declined to be that from which its purpose had been to emancipate her. As though presiding aloof upon the new, she deliberately remained to represent to us the threatful portent of the old. We were three strangers. I do not know what Clytie thought, what life she led which the food we raised and cooked in unison, the cloth we spun and wove together, nourished and sheltered. But I expected that because she and I were open, I honorable, enemies. But I did not even know what Judith thought and felt. We slept in the same room, the three of us. This for more than to conserve the firewood which we had to carry in ourselves. We did it for safety. It was winter soon, and already soldiers were beginning to come back. The stragglers, not all of them tramps, ruffians, but men who had risked and lost everything, suffered beyond endurance and had returned now to a ruined land, not the same men who had marched away but transformed. And this the worst, the ultimate degradation to which war brings the spirit, the soul, into the likeness of that man who abuses from very despair and pity the beloved wife or mistress who in his absence has been raped. We were afraid. We fed them. We gave them what and all we had, and we would have assumed their wounds and left them whole again if we could, but we were afraid of them. We waked and fulfilled the endless, tedious obligations which the sheer holden to life and breath entailed. We would sit before the fire after supper, the three of us in that state where the very bones and muscles are too tired to rest, when the attenuated and invincible spirit has changed and shaped even hopelessness into the easy obliviousness of a worn garment. And talk of 100 things, the weary recurrent triviata of our daily lives, of 1,000 things, but not of one. We talked of him, Thomas Sutpen, of the end of the war. We could all see it now, and when he would return, of what he would do, how begin the Herculean task which we knew he would set himself, into which, oh yes, we knew this too, he would undoubtedly sweep us with the old ruthlessness whether we would or no. We talked of Henry, quietly, that normal, useless, impotent woman worrying about the absent male, as to how he fared, if he were cold or hungry or not, just as we talked of his father, as if both they and we still lived in that time which that shot, those running mad feet, had put a period to and then obliterated, as though that afternoon had never been. But not once did we mention Charles Bond. There were two afternoons in the late fall when Judith was absent, returning at supper time serene and calm. I did not ask, and I did not follow her. Yet I knew, and I knew that Clytie knew, that she had gone to clear that grave of dead leaves and the sere brown refuse of the cedars. That mound vanishing slowly back into the earth, beneath which we had buried nothing. No, there had been no shot. That sound was merely the sharp and final clap-to of a door between us and all that was, all that might have been. A retroactive severance of the stream of event. A forever crystallized instant in imponderable time, accomplished by three weak yet indomitable women, which, preceding the accomplished fact which we declined, refused, robbed the brother of the prey, reft the murderer of a victim for his very bullet. That was how we lived for 7 months. And then one afternoon in January, Thomas Sutphen came home. Someone looked up from where we were preparing the garden for another year's food, and saw him riding up the drive. And then one evening I became engaged to marry him. It took me just 3 months. Do you mind how I don't say he, but I? Yes, I, just 3 months, who for 20 years had looked on him, when I did, had to, look, as an ogre, some beast out of a tale to frighten children with, who had seen his own get upon my dead sister's body already begin to destroy one another, yet who must come to him like a whistled dog at that first opportunity, that noon when he who had been seeing me for 20 years should first raise his head and pause and look at me. Oh, I hold no brief for myself who could, and would, I doubtless have already, give you 1,000 specious reasons good enough for women, ranging from woman's natural inconsistency to the desire or even hope for possible wealth, position, or even the fear of dying manless, which, so they will doubtless tell you, old maids always have, or for revenge. No, I hold no brief for me. I could have gone home, and I did not. Perhaps I should have gone home, but I did not. As Judith and Clytie did, I stood there before the rotting portico and watched him ride up on that gaunt and jaded horse on which he did not seem to sit, but rather seemed to project himself ahead like a mirage, in some fierce dynamic rigidity of impatience which the gaunt horse, the saddle, the boots, the leaf-colored and threadbare coat with its tarnished and flapping braid containing the sentient, though nerveless, shell, could not keep up with, which seemed to precede him as he dismounted, and out of which he said, "Well, daughter," and stooped and touched his beard to Judith's forehead, who had not, did not move, who stood rigid and still and immobile of face, and within which they spoke four sentences of simple, direct words, behind, beneath, above which I felt that same rapport of communal blood which I had sensed that day while Clytie held me from the stairs. "Henry's not—" "No, he's not here." "Ah, and—" "Yes, Henry killed him," and then burst into tears. Yes, burst, who had not wept yet, who had brought down the stairs that afternoon and worn ever since that cold, calm face which had stopped me in mid-running at that closed door. Yes, burst, as if that entire accumulation of 7 months were erupting spontaneously from every pore in one incredible evacuation. She not moving a muscle, and then vanishing, disappearing as instantaneously as if the very fierce and arid aura which he had enclosed her in were drying the tears faster than they emerged. And still standing with his hands on her shoulders and looked at Clytie and said, "Ah, Clytie," and then at me, the same face which I had last seen, only a little thinner, the same ruthless eyes, the hair grizzled a little now, and no recognition in the face at all until Judith said, "It's Rosa, Aunt Rosa. She lives here now." That was all. He rode up the drive and into our lives again and left no ripple save those instantaneous and incredible tears. Because he himself was not there, not in the house where we spent our days, had not stopped there. The shell of him was there, using the room which we had kept for him and eating the food which we produced and prepared, as if it could neither feel the softness of the bed nor make distinction between the viands either as to quality or taste. Yes, he wasn't there. Something ate with us. We talked to it, and it answered questions. It sat with us before the fire at night, and, rousing without any warning from some profound and bemused complete inertia, talked, not to us, the six ears, the three minds capable of listening, but to the air, the waiting grim decaying presence, spirit of the house itself. Talking that which sounded like the bombast of a madman who creates within his very coffin walls his fabulous immeasurable Camelots and Carcassons. Not absent from the place, the arbitrary square of earth which he had named Sutpen's Hundred, not that at all. He was absent only from the room, and that because he had to be elsewhere, a part of him encompassing each ruined field and fallen fence and crumbling wall of cabin or cotton house or crib. Himself diffused and in solution, held by that electric furious immobile urgency and awareness of short time and the need for haste, as if he had just drawn breath and looked about and realized that he was old, he was 59, and was concerned, not afraid, concerned, not that old age might have left him impotent to do what he intended to do, but that he might not have time to do it in before he would have to die. We were right about what he would intend to do, that he would not even pause for breath before undertaking to restore his house and plantation as near as possible to what it had been. We did not know how he would go about it, nor, I believe, did he. He could not have known, who came home with nothing, to nothing, to 4 years less than nothing. But it did not stop him, intimidate him. His was that cold, alert fury of the gambler who knows that he may lose anyway, but that with a second's flagging of the fierce constant will he is sure to, and who keeps suspense from ever quite crystallizing by sheer fierce manipulation of the cards or dice until the ducts and glands of luck begin to flow again. He did not pause, did not take that day or two to let the bones and flesh of 59 recuperate. The day or two in which he might have talked, not about us and what we had been doing, but about himself, the past 4 years. For all he ever told us, there might not have been any war at all, or it on another planet, and no stake of his risked on it, no flesh and blood of his to suffer by it. That natural period, during which bitter though unnamed defeat might have exhausted itself to something like peace, like quiet, in the raging and incredulous recounting, which enables man to bear with living, of that feather's balance between victory and disaster, which makes that defeat unbearable which, turning against him, yet declined to slay him who, still alive, yet cannot bear to live with it. We hardly ever saw him. He would be gone from dawn until dark, he and Jones and another man or two that he had got from somewhere and paid with something, perhaps the same coin in which he had paid that foreign architect, cajolery, promise, threat, and at last force. That was the winter when we began to learn what carpetbagger meant, and people, women, locked doors and windows at night and began to frighten each other with tales of Negro uprisings, when the ruined, the 4 years' fallow and neglected land lay more idle yet while men with pistols in their pockets gathered daily at secret meeting places in the towns. He did not make one of these. I remember how one night a deputation called, rode out through the mud of early March and put him to the point of definite yes or no, with them or against them, friend or enemy. And he refused, declined, offered them, with no change of gaunt, ruthless face nor level voice, defiance, if it was defiance they wanted, telling them that if every man in the South would do as he himself was doing, would see to the restoration of his own land, the general land and South would save itself, and ushered them from the room and from the house and stood plain in the doorway holding a lamp above his head while their spokesman delivered his ultimatum. "This may be war, Sutpen," and answered, "I am used to it." Oh, yes, I watched him, watched his old man's solitary fury fight now not with the stubborn yet slowly tractable earth, as it had done before, but now against the ponderable weight of the changed new time itself, as though he were trying to dam a river with his bare hands and a shingle. And this for the same spurious delusion of reward which had failed, betrayed, and would this time destroy him once. I see the analogy myself now, the accelerating circle's fatal curve and course of his ruthless pride, his lust for vain magnificence, though I did not then. And how could I, turned 20 true enough, yet still a child, still living in that womb-like corridor where the world came not even as living echo but as dead incomprehensible shadow, where with the quiet and unalarmed amazement of a child I watched the miragey antics of men and women, my father, my sister, Thomas Sutpin, Judith, Henry, Charles Bond, called honor, principle, marriage, love, bereavement, death. The child who, watching him, was not a child, but one of that triumvirate mother-woman which we three, Judith, Clytie, and I, made, which fed and clothed and warmed the static shell and so gave vent and scope to the fierce vain illusion, and so said, at last my life is worth something, even though it only shields and guards the antic fury of an insane child. And then one afternoon I was in the garden with a hoe where the path came up from the stable lot. I looked up and saw him looking at me. He had seen me for 20 years, but now he was looking at me. He stood there in the path looking at me in the middle of the afternoon. That was it. That it should have been in the middle of the afternoon, when he should not have been anywhere near the house at all, but miles away and invisible somewhere among his 100 square miles which they had not troubled to begin to take away from him yet. Perhaps not even at this point or at that point, but diffused. Not attenuated to thinness, but enlarged, magnified, encompassing as though in a prolonged and unbroken instant of tremendous effort, embracing and holding intact that 10-mile square, while he faced from the brink of disaster, invincible and unafraid, what he must have known would be the final defeat. But instead of that, standing there in the path, looking at me with something curious and strange in his face, as if the barn lot, the path at the instant when he came in sight of me, had been a swamp out of which he had emerged without having been forewarned that he was about to enter light, and then went on. The face, the same face. It was not love. I do not say that, not gentleness or pity. Just a sudden overburst of light, illumination, who had been told that his son had done murder and vanished and said, "Ah, well, Clytie." He went on to the house. But it was not love, I do not claim that. I hold no brief for myself, I do not excuse it. I could have said that he had needed, used me. Why should I rebel now, because he would use me more? But I did not say it. I could say this time I do not know, and I would tell the truth. Because I do not know. He was gone. I did not even know that either, since there is a metabolism of the spirit as well as of the entrails, in which the stored accumulations of long time burn, generate, create, and break some maidenhead of the ravening meat. I in a second's time, yes, lost all the shibboleth erupting of cannot, will not, never will in one red instant's fierce obliteration. This was my instant, who could have fled then and did not, who found that he had gone on and did not remember when he had walked away, who found my okra bed finished without remembering the completing of it, who sat at the supper table that night with the familiar dream-cloudy shell which we had grown used to. He did not look at me again during the meal. I might have said then, to what deluded sewer gush of dreamin' does the incorrigible flesh betray us, but I did not. And then before the fire in Judith's bedroom sat as we always did until he came in the door and looked at us and said, "Judith, you and Clytie," and ceased, still entering, then said, "No, never mind. Rosa will not mind if you both hear too, since we are short for time and busy with what we have of it," and came and stopped and put his hand on my head, and I do not know what he looked at while he spoke, save that by the sound of his voice it was not at us nor at anything in that room, said, "You may think I made your sister Ellen no very good husband. You probably do think so. But even if you will not discount the fact that I am older now, I believe I can promise that I shall do no worse, at least, for you." That was my courtship, that minute's exchanged look in a kitchen garden, that hand upon my head in his daughter's bedroom, a ukase, a decree, a serene and florid boast like a sentence, aye, and delivered in the same attitude, not to be spoken and heard, but to be read carved in the bland stone which pediments a forgotten and nameless effigy. I do not excuse it. I claim no brief, no pity, who did not answer, "I will," not because I was not asked, because there was no place, no niche, no interval for reply. because I could have made one. I could have forced that niche myself if I had willed to. A niche not shaped to fit mild, yes, but some blind, desperate female weapon's frenzied slash whose very gaping wound had cried, "No, no," and "Help and save me." No, no brief, no pity. Who did not even move, who sat beneath that hard, oblivious childhood ogre's hand and heard him speak to Judith now, heard Judith's feet, saw Judith's hand, not Judith. That palm in which I read as from a printed chronicle the orphanin, the hardship, the bereave of love. The 4 hard barren years of scoriatin' loom, of axe and hoe and all the other tools decreed for men to use. And upon it lying the ring which he gave Ellen in the church almost 30 years ago. Yes, analogy and paradox and madness too. I sat there and felt, not watched him slip the ring onto my finger in my turn. He was sitting now also in the chair which we called Clytie's, while she stood just beyond the firelight's range beside the chimney, and listened to his voice as Ellen must have listened in her own spirit's April 30 years ago. He talking not about me, or love, or marriage, not even about himself, and to no sane mortal listening, nor out of any sanity, but to the very dark forces of fate which he had evoked and dared, out of that wild braggart dream, where an intact Sutpen's Hundred which no more had actual being now, and would never have again, than it had when Ellen first heard it. As though in the restoration of that ring to a living finger he had turned all time back 20 years and stopped it, froze it. Yes, I sat there and listened to his voice and told myself, why, he is mad. He will decree this marriage for tonight and perform his own ceremony, himself both groom and minister. Pronounce his own wild benediction on it with the very bedwood candle in his hand. And I'm mad, too, for I will acquiesce, succumb, abet him and plunge down. No, I hold no brief, ask no pity. If I was saved that night, and I was saved, mine was to be some later colder sacrifice when I should be free of all excuse of the surprised, importunate, traitorous flesh. It was no fault, no doing of my own, but rather because, once he had restored the ring, he ceased to look at me save as he had looked for the 20 years before that afternoon, as if he had reached for the moment some interval of sanity such as the mad know, just as the sane have intervals of madness to keep them aware that they are sane. It was more than that, even. For 3 months now he had seen me daily, though he had not looked at me since I merely made one of that triumvirate who received his gruff unspoken man's gratitude for the Spartan ease we supplied. Not to his comfort, perhaps, but at least to the mad dream he lived in. But for the next 2 months he did not even see me. Perhaps the reason was the obvious one. He was too busy. That having accomplished his engagement, granted that was what he wanted, he did not need to see me. Certainly he did not. There was not even any date set for the wedding. It was almost as though that very afternoon did not exist, had never happened. I might not have even been there in the house. Worse, I could have gone, returned home, and he would not have missed me. I was, whatever it was he wanted of me, not my being, my presence, just my existence, whatever it was that Rosa Coldfield or any young female no blood kin to him represented in whatever it was he wanted. Because I will do him this credit. He had never once thought about what he asked me to do until the moment he asked it, because I know that he would not have waited 2 months or even 2 days to ask it. My presence was to him only the absence of black morass and snarled vine and creeper to that man who had struggled through a swamp with nothing to guide or drive him. No hope, no light, only some incorrigibility of undefeat, and blundered at last and without warning onto dry solid ground and sun and air. If there could have been such thing as sun to him, if anyone or anything could have competed with the white glare of his madness. Yes, mad, yet not so mad, because there is a practicality to viciousness. The thief, the liar, the murderer even has faster rules than virtue ever has. Why not madness too? If he was mad, it was only his compelling dream which was insane and not his methods. It was no madman who bargained and cajoled hard manual labor out of men like Jones. It was no madman who kept clear of the sheets and hoods and night-galloping horses, with which men who were once his acquaintances, even if not his friends, discharged the canker suppuration of defeat. It was no madman's plan or tactics which gained him at the lowest possible price the sole woman available to wive him, and by the one device which could have gained his point. Not madman, no. Since surely there is something in madness, even the demoniac, which Satan flees, aghast at his own handiwork, and which God looks on in pity. Some spark, some crumb to leaven and redeem that articulated flesh, that speech, sight, hear and taste and being which we call human man. But no matter. I will tell you what he did and let you be the judge. Or try to tell you, because there are some things for which 3 words are 3 too many, and 3,000 words that many words too less, and this is one of them. It can be told. I could take that many sentences, repeat the bold, blank, naked, and outrageous words just as he spoke them, and bequeath you only that same aghast and outraged unbelief I knew when I comprehended what he meant. Or take 3,000 sentences and leave you only that why, and why that I have asked and listened to for almost 50 years. But I will let you be the judge and let you tell me if I was not right. You see, I was that son, or thought I was, who did believe there was that spark, that crumb in madness which is divine, though madness know no word itself for terror or for pity. There was an ogre of my childhood which, before my birth, removed my only sister to its grim ogre-born and produced 2 half-phantom children whom I was not encouraged and did not desire to associate with, as if my late-born solitude had taught me presentiment of that fateful intertwining, warned me of that fatal snarly climax before I knew the name for murder. And I forgave it. There was a shape which rode away beneath a flag and, demon or no, courageously suffered. And I did more than just forgive. I slew it. Because the body, the blood, the memory which that ogre had dwelt in returned 5 years later and held out its hand and said, "Come," as you might say it to a dog, and I came. Yes, the body, the face, with the right name and memory, even the correct remembrance of what and whom, except myself, and was that not but further proof, it had left behind and returned to. But not the ogre, villain true enough, but a mortal, fallible one, less to invoke fear than pity. But no ogre, mad true enough, but I told myself, why should not madness be its own victim also? Or, why may it be not even madness, but solitary despair in titan conflict with the lonely and foredoomed and indomitable iron spirit? But no ogre, because it was dead, vanished, consumed somewhere in flame and sulphur reek, perhaps, among the lonely craggy peaks of my childhood's solitary remembering, or forgetting. I was that son, who believed that he, after that evening in Judith's room, was not oblivious of me, but only unconscious and receptive, like the swamp-freed pilgrim feeling earth and tasting sun and light again, and aware of neither, but only of darknesses and morasses lack. Who did believe that there was that magic in unkin blood which we call by the pallid name of love that could be, might be, son for him, though I the youngest, weakest, where Judith and Clytie both would cast no shadow. Yes, I the youngest there, yet potently, without measured and measurable age, since I alone of them could say, O furious mad old man, I hold no substance that will fit your dream, but I can give you airy space and scope for your delirium. And then one afternoon, oh, there was a fate in it, afternoon and afternoon and afternoon, do you see? The death of hope and love, the death of pride and principle, and then the death of everything save the old outraged and aghast unbelieving which has lasted for 43 years. He returned to the house and called me, shouting from the back gallery until I came down. Oh, I told you he had not thought of it until that moment, that prolonged moment which contained the distance between the house and wherever it was he had been standing when he thought of it. And this, too, coincident. It was the very day on which he knew definitely and at last exactly how much of his 100 square miles he would be able to save and keep and call his own, on the day when he would have to die, that no matter what happened to him now, he would at least retain the shell of Sutpen's 100, even though a better name for it would now be Sutpen's 1. called, shouted for me until I came down. He had not even waited to tether his horse. He stood with the reins over his arm, and no hand on my head now, and spoke the bald, outrageous words exactly as if he were consulting with Jones or with some other man about a bitch dog or a cow or mare. They will have told you how I came back home. Oh, yes, I know. Rosie Coldfield, lose him, weep him, caught a man but couldn't keep him. Oh, yes, I know. And kind, too, they would be kind. Rosa Coldfield, warped, bitter, orphaned country stick called Rosa Coldfield, safely engaged at last, and so off the town, the county. They will have told you how I went out there to live for the rest of my life, seeing in my nephew's murderin' an act of God enabling me ostensibly to obey my dying sister's request, that I save at least one of the two children which she had doomed by conceiving them, but actually to be in the house when he returned, who, being a demon, would therefore be impervious to shot and shell, and so would return. I waited for him because I was young still, who had buried no hopes to bugles beneath a flag, and ripe for marrying in this time and place where most of the young men were dead, and all the living ones either old or already married or tired, too tired for love. He my best, my only chance in this, an environment where at best and even lacking war my chances would have been slender enough, since I was not only a southern gentlewoman, but the very modest character of whose background and circumstances must needs be their own affirmation, since had I been the daughter of a wealthy planter I could have married almost anyone, but being the daughter merely of a small storekeeper I could even afford to accept flowers from almost no one, and so would have been doomed to marry at last some casual apprentice clerk in my father's business. Yes, they will have told you, who was young and had buried hopes only during that night which was 4 years long, when beside a shuttered and unsleeping candle she embalmed the war and its heritage of suffering and injustice and sorrow on the backsides of the pages within an old account book, embalming, blotting from the breathable air the poisonous secret effluvium of lusting and hating and killing. They will have told you, daughter of an ambuscé who had to turn to a demon, a villain, and therefore she had been right in hating her father, since if he had not died in that attic, she would not have had to go out there to find food and protection and shelter, and if she had not had to depend on his food and clothing, even if she did help to grow and weave it, to keep her alive and warm until simple justice demanded that she make what return for it he might require of her commensurate with honor, she would not have become engaged to him. And if she had not become engaged to him, she would not have had to lie at night asking herself why and why and why, as she has done for 43 years, as if she had been instinctively right even as a child in hating her father. And so these 43 years of impotent and unbearable outrage were the revenge of some sophisticated and ironic sterile nature on her, for having hated that which gave her life. Yes, Rosa Coldfield, engaged at last, who, lacking the fact that her sister had bequeathed her at least something of shelter and kin, might have become a charge upon the town. And now Rosie Coldfield, lose him, weep him, found a man but failed to keep him. Rosa Coldfield, who would be right, only right, being right, is not enough for women who would rather be wrong than just that who want the man who was wrong to admit it. And that's what she can't forgive him for, not for the insult, not even for having jilted her, but for being dead. Oh, yes, I know, I know. How 2 months later they learned that she had packed up her belongings, that is, put on the shawl and hat again, and come back to town, to live alone in the house where her parents were dead and gone, and where Judith would come now and then and bring her some of what food they had out at Sutpen's Hundred, and which only dire necessity, the brute inexplicable flesh's stubborn will to live, brought her, Miss Coldfield, to accept. And it dire indeed, because now the town, farmers passing, negro servants scorned to work in white kitchens, would see her before sunup gathering greens along garden fences, pulling them through the fence, since she had no garden of her own, no seed to plant one with, no tools to work it with herself, even if she had known completely how, who had had only the freshman year at gardening and doubtless would not have worked it if she had known, who had never surrendered, reaching through the garden fence and gathering vegetables, who would have been welcome to enter the garden and get them, and they would have even done the gathering and sent them to her, since there were more people than Judge Benbow who would leave baskets of provisions on her front porch at night. But she would not permit them, who would not even use a stick to reach through the fence and draw the vegetables to where she could grasp them, the reach of her unaided arm being the limit of brigandage, which she never passed. And it not to keep from being seen stealing, which sent her forth before the town was awake, because if she had had a nigger she would have sent him forth in broad daylight to forage, where she would not have cared, exactly as the cavalry heroes whom she wrote verse about would have sent their men. Yes, Rosie Coldfield, lose him, weep him, caught a bow but couldn't keep him. Oh, yes, they will tell you. Found a bow and was insulted, something heard and not forgiven. Not so much for the saying of it, but for having thought about her so that when she heard it she realized like a thunderclap that it must have been in his mind for a day, a week, even a month maybe. He looking at her daily with that in his mind and she not even knowing it. But I forgave him. They will tell you different, but I did. Why shouldn't I? I had nothing to forgive. I had not lost him because I never owned him. A certain segment of rotten mud walked into my life, spoke that to me which I had never heard before and never shall again, and then walked out. That was all. I never owned him, certainly not in that sewer sense, which you would mean by that and maybe think, but you are wrong, I mean. That did not matter. That was not even the nub of the insult. I mean that he was not owned by anyone or anything in this world, had never been, would never be, not even by Ellen, not even by Jones's granddaughter. Because he was not articulated in this world. He was a walking shadow. He was the light-blinded, bat-like image of his own torment cast by the fierce demoniac lantern up from beneath the earth's crust, and hence in retrograde, reverse, from abysmal and chaotic dark to eternal and abysmal dark, completing his descending, do you mark the gradation, ellipsis, clinging, trying to cling with vain, unsubstantial hands to what he hoped would hold him, save him, arrest him. Ellen, do you mark them? Myself? Then last of all, that fatherless daughter of Wash Jones's only child, who, so I heard once, died in a Memphis brothel. To find severance, even if not rest and peace, at last in the stroke of a rusty scythe. I was told, informed of that, too, though not by Jones this time, but by someone else kind enough to turn aside and tell me he was dead. Dead, I cried, dead! You! You lie, you're not dead. Heaven cannot and hell dare not have you. But Quentin was not listening, because there was also something which he too could not pass. That door, the running feet on the stairs beyond it almost a continuation of the faint shot, the two women, the negress and the white girl in her underthings, made of flower sacking when there had been flour, of window curtains when not, pausing, looking at the door, the yellowed creamy mass of old intricate satin and lace spread carefully on the bed, and then caught swiftly up by the white girl and held before her as the door crashed in, and the brother stood there, hatless, with his shaggy bayonet-trimmed hair, his gaunt, worn, unshaven face, his patched and faded gray tunic, the pistol still hanging against his flank. The two of them, brother and sister, curiously alike, as if the difference in sex had merely sharpened the common blood to a terrific, an almost unbearable similarity, speaking to one another in short, brief, staccato sentences like slaps, as if they stood breast to breast, striking one another in turn, neither making any attempt to guard against the blows. Now you can't marry him.
Why can't I marry him?
Because he's dead.
Dead?
Yes, I killed him. He, Quentin, couldn't pass that. He was not even listening to her. He said, "Ma'am? What's that? What did you say?"
"There's something in that house."
"In that house? It's Clytie, don't she?"
"No. Something living in it, hidden in it. It has been out there for 4 years, living hidden in that house."
Chapter 6. There was snow on Shreve's overcoat sleeve, his ungloved blonde square hand red and raw with cold, vanishing. Then on the table before Quentin, lying on the open textbook beneath the lamp, the white oblong of envelope, the familiar blurred mechanical Jefferson Jan 10, 1910, Miss. And then opened the My Dear Son, in his father's sloped fine hand, out of that dead dusty summer
where he had prepared for Harvard so that his father's hand could lie on a strange lamp-lit table in Cambridge. That dead summer twilight, the wisteria, the cigar smell, the fireflies, attenuated up from Mississippi and into this strange room, across this strange iron New England snow. My dear son, Miss Rosa Coldfield was buried yesterday. She remained in the coma for almost 2 weeks, and 2 days ago she died without regaining consciousness and without pain, they say. And whatever they mean by that, since it has always seemed to me that the only painless death must be that which takes the intelligence by violent surprise, and from the rear, so to speak, since if death be anything at all beyond a brief and peculiar emotional state of the bereaved, it must be a brief and likewise peculiar state of the subject as well. And if aught can be more painful to any intelligence above that of a child or an idiot, than a slow and gradual confronting with that which over a long period of bewilderment and dread it has been taught to regard as an irrevocable and unplumbable finality, I do not know it. And if there can be either access of comfort or cessation of pain in the ultimate escape from a stubborn and amazed outrage which over a period of 43 years has been companionship and bread and fire and all, I do not know that either. Bringing with it that very September evening itself, and he soon needing, required, to say, no, neither aunt, cousin, nor uncle Rosa, Miss Rosa, Miss Rosa Coldfield, an old lady that died young of outrage in 1866 one summer, and then Shreve, you mean she was no kin to you, no kin to you at all, that there was actually one Southern Bayard or Guinevere who was no kin to you? Then what did she die for? And that not Shreve's first time, nobody's first time in Cambridge since September. Tell about the South. What's it like there? What do they do there? Why do they live there? Why do they live at all? That very September evening, when Mr. Compson stopped talking at last, he, Quentin, walked out of his father's talking at last, because it was now time to go. Not because he had heard it all, because he had not been listening, since he had something which he still was unable to pass. That door, that gaunt, tragic, dramatic, self-hypnotized, youthful face, like the tragedian in a college play. An academic Hamlet waked from some trancement of the curtains falling, and blundering across the dusty stage from which the rest of the cast had departed last commencement. The sister facing him across the wedding dress, which she was not to use, not even to finish. The two of them slashing at one another with 12 or 14 words, and most of these the same words repeated 2 or 3 times, so that when you boiled it down they did it with 8 or 10. And she, Miss Coldfield, had on the shawl, as he had known she would, and the bonnet, black once but faded now to that fierce muted metallic green of old peacock feathers, and the black reticule almost as large as a carpet-bag, containing all the keys which the house possessed, cupboard, closet, and door, some of which would not even turn in locks which, shot home, could be solved by any child with a hairpin or a wad of chewing gum, some of which no longer even fit the locks they had been made for, like old married people who no longer have anything in common, to do or to talk about, save the same general weight of air to displace and breathe, and general oblivious biding earth to bear their weight. That evening, the 12 miles behind the fat mare in the moonless September dust, the trees along the road not rising soaring, as trees should, but squatting like huge fowl, their leaves ruffled and heavily separate like the feathers of panting fowls, heavy with 60 days of dust, the roadside undergrowth coated with heat-vulcanized dust, and, seen through the dust cloud in which the horse and buggy moved, appeared like masses stranding delicate and rigid and immobly upward at perpendiculars absolute, in some old dead volcanic water refined to the oxygenless first principle of liquid. The dust cloud in which the buggy moved, not blowing away because it had been raised by no wind and was supported by no air, but evoked, materialized about them, instantaneous and eternal. Cubic foot for cubic foot of dust, to cubic foot for cubic foot of horse and buggy. Peripatetic beneath the branch-shredded vistas of flat, black, fiercely and heavily starred sky. The dust cloud moving on, enclosing them with not threat exactly, but maybe warning, bland, almost friendly, warning, as if to say, "Come on if you like, but I will get there first. Accumulating ahead of you, I will arrive first, lifting, sloping gently upward under hooves and wheels, so that you will find no destination but will merely abrupt gently onto a plateau and a panorama of harmless and inscrutable night, and there will be nothing for you to do but return, and so I would advise you not to go, to turn back now and let what is be." He, Quentin, agreeing to this, sitting in the buggy beside the implacable doll-sized old woman clutching her cotton umbrella, smelling the heat-distilled old woman flesh, the heat-distilled camphor in the old fold creases of the shawl, feeling exactly like an electric bulb, blood and skin, since the buggy disturbed not enough air to cool him with motion, created not enough motion within him to make his skin sweat, thinking, "Good Lord, yes, let's don't find him or it, try to find him or it, risk disturbing him or it." Then Shreve again, "Wait, wait, you mean that this old gal, this Aunt Rosa?"
"Miss Rosa," Quentin said.
All right, that this old dame, this Aunt Rosa, Miss Rosa, I tell you. All right, that this old, this Aunt Ro- All right, that hadn't been out there, hadn't set foot in the house even in 43 years, yet who not only said there was somebody hidden in it, but found somebody that would believe her, would drive that 12 miles out there in a buggy at midnight to see if she was right or not?
Yes, Quentin said.
That this old dame that grew up in a household like an overpopulated mausoleum, with no call or claim on her time but the hating of her father and aunt and her sister's husband in peace and comfort, and waiting for the day when they would prove not only to themselves but to everybody else that she had been right. So one night the aunt slid down the rainpipe with a horse trader, and she was right about the aunt, so that fixed that. Then her father nailed himself up in the attic to keep from being drafted into the rebel army and starved to death, so that fixed that, except for the unavoidable possibility that when the moment came for him to admit to himself that she had been right, he may not have been able to speak or may not have had anyone to tell it to. So she was right about the father, too, since if he hadn't made General Lee and Jeff Davis mad, he wouldn't have had to nail himself up and die. And if he hadn't died, he wouldn't have left her an orphan and a pauper and so situated, left susceptible to a situation where she could receive this mortal affront. And right about the brother-in-law, because if he hadn't been a demon, his children wouldn't have needed protection from him, and she wouldn't have had to go out there and be betrayed by the old meat, and find instead of a widowed Agamemnon to her Cassandra, an ancient stiff-jointed Pyramus to her eager though untried Thisbe, who could approach her in this unbidden April's compounded demonry and suggest that they breed together for test and sample, and if it was a boy they would marry, would not have had to be blown back to town on the initial blast of that horror and outrage to eat of gall and wormwood stolen through paling fences at dawn. So this was not fixed at all and forever, because she couldn't even tell it because of who her successor was. Not because he found a successor by just turning around and no day's loss of time even, but because of who the successor was, that she might conceivably have ever suffered a situation where she could or would have to decline any office which her successor could have been deemed worthy, even by a demon, to fill. This not fixed at all, since when the moment came for him to admit he had been wrong, she would have the same trouble with him she had with her father. He would be dead too, since she doubtless foresaw the scythe, if for no other reason than that it would be the final outrage and affront, like the hammer and nails in her father's business. That scythe, symbolic laurel of a Caesar's triumph. That rusty scythe loaned by the demon himself to Jones more than 2 years ago to cut the weeds away from the shanty doorway to smooth the path for rutting. That rusty blade garlanded with each successive day's gaudy ribbon or cheap bead for the, how did she put it? Slut wasn't all, was it? To walk in. That scythe beyond whose symbolic shape he, even though dead, even when earth itself declined any longer to bear his weight, jeered at her?
Yes, Quentin said.
That this Faustus, this demon, this Beelzebub, fled hiding from some momentary flashy glare of his creditor's outraged face, exasperated beyond all endurance, hiding, scuttling into respectability like a jackal into a rock pile. So she thought at first, until she realized that he was not hiding, did not want to hide, was merely engaged in one final frenzy of evil and harm-doing before the creditor overtook him this next time for good and all. This Faustus, who appeared suddenly one Sunday with 2 pistols and 20 subsidiary demons, and skull-dugged 100 miles of land out of a poor ignorant Indian and built the biggest house on it you ever saw, and went away with 6 wagons and came back with the crystal tapestries and the Wedgwood chairs to furnish it, and nobody knew if he had robbed another steamboat or had just dug up a little more of the old loot, who hid horns and tail beneath human raiment and a beaver hat, and chose, bought her, outswapped his father-in-law, wasn't it? A wife after 3 years to scrutinize, weigh, and compare. Not from one of the local ducal houses, but from the lesser baronage whose principality was so far decayed that there would be no risk of his wife bringing him for dowry delusions of grandeur before he should be equipped for it. Yet not so far decayed, but that she might keep them both from getting lost among the new knives and forks and spoons that he had bought. A wife who not only would consolidate the hiding, but could, would, and did breed him 2 children to fend and shield, both in themselves and in their progeny, the brittle bones and tired flesh of an old man against the day when the creditor would run him to earth for the last time, and he couldn't get away. And so sure enough the daughter fell in love, the son the agent for the providing of that living bulwark between him, the demon, and the creditor's bailiff hand, until the son should marry and thus ensure him doubled and compounded. And then the demon must turn square around and run not only the fiancée out of the house and not only the son out of the house, but so corrupt, seduce, and mesmerize the son that he, the son, should do the office of the outraged father's pistol hand when fornication threatened, so that the demon should return from the war 5 years later and find accomplished and complete the situation he had been working for. Son fled for good now with a noose behind him, daughter doomed to spinsterhood. And then, almost before his foot was out of the stirrup, he, the demon, set out and got himself engaged again in order to replace that progeny the hopes of which he had himself destroyed?
Yes, Quentin said.
Came back home and found his chances of descendants gone where his children had attended to that, and his plantation ruined, fields fallow except for a fine stand of weeds, and taxes and levies and penalties sowed by United States marshals and such, and all his niggers gone where the Yankees had attended to that, and you would have thought he would have been satisfied. Yet before his foot was out of the stirrup, he not only set out to try to restore his plantation to what it used to be, like maybe he was hoping to fool the creditor by illusion and obfuscation, by concealing behind the illusion that time and change had not elapsed and occurred, the fact that he was now almost 60 years old, until he could get himself a new batch of children to bulwark him, but chose for this purpose the last woman on earth he might have hoped to prevail on, this Aunt All right. That hated him, that had always hated him, yet choosing her with a kind of outrageous bravado, as if a kind of despairing conviction of his irresistibility or invulnerability were a part of the price he had got for whatever it was he had sold the creditor, since according to the old dame he never had had a soul. Proposed to her and was accepted. Then 3 months later, with no date ever set for the wedding and marriage itself not mentioned one time since, and on the very day when he established definitely that he would be able to keep at least some of his land and how much, he approached her and suggested they breed like a couple of dogs together, inventing with fiendish cunning the thing which husbands and fiancés have been trying to invent for 10 million years. The thing that, without harming her or giving her grounds for civil or tribal action, would not only blast the little dream woman out of the dovecote, but leave her irrevocably husbanded, and himself, husband or fiancé, already safely cuckolded before she can draw breath, with the abstract carcass of outrage and revenge. Who said it and was free now, forevermore now, of threat or meddling from anyone, since he had at last eliminated the last member of his late wife's family. Free now. Son fled to Texas or California or maybe even South America. Daughter doomed to spinsterhood to live until he died. Since after that it wouldn't matter, in that rotting house, K caring for him and feeding him, raising chickens and peddling the eggs for the clothes she and Clytie couldn't make. So that he didn't even need to be a demon now, but just mad, impotent old man who had realized at last that his dream of restoring his Sutpen's Hundred was not only vain, but that what he had left of it would never support him and his family, and so running his little crossroads store with a stock of plowshares and hamstrings and calico and kerosene and cheap beads and ribbons, and a clientele of freed niggers and, what is it, the word, white what? Yes, trash. With Jones for clerk, and who knows maybe what delusions of making money out of the store to rebuild the plantation. Who had escaped twice now, got himself into it, and been freed by the creditor who set his children to destroying one another before he had posterity. And he decided that maybe he was wrong in being free, and so got into it again, and then decided that he was wrong in being unfree, and so got out of it again. And then turned right around and bought his way back into it with beads and calico and striped candy out of his own showcase and off his shelves? Yes, Quentin said. He sounds just like Father, he thought, glancing, his face quiet, reposed, curiously almost sullen, for a moment at Shreve leaning forward into the lamp, his naked torso pink gleaming and baby smooth, cherubic, almost hairless, the twin moons of his spectacles glinting against his moon-like rubicund face, smelling, Quentin, the cigar and the wisteria, seeing the fireflies blowing and winking in the September dusk. Just exactly like Father, if Father had known as much about it the night before I went out there as he did the day after I came back. Thinking, mad, impotent old man who realized at last that there must be some limit even to the capabilities of a demon for doing harm, who must have seen his situation as that of the showgirl, the pony, who realizes that the principal tune she prances to comes not from horn and fiddle and drum, but from a clock and calendar. Must have seen himself as the old worn-out cannon, which realizes that it can deliver just one more fierce shot and crumble to dust in its own furious blast and recoil. Who looked about upon the scene which was still within his scope and compass, and saw sun gone, vanished, more insuperable to him now than if the sun were dead, since now, if the sun still lived, his name would be different, and those to call him by it strangers, and whatever dragon's outcroppin' of Sutpen blood the sun might sow on the body of whatever strange woman would therefore carry on the tradition, accomplish the hereditary evil and harm under another name and upon and among people who will never have heard the right one. Daughter doomed to spinsterhood who had chosen spinsterhood already before there was anyone named Charles Bond, since the aunt who came to succor her in bereavement and sorrow found neither, but instead that calm, absolutely impenetrable face between a homespun dress and sunbonnet, seen before a closed door, and again in a cloudy swirl of chickens while Jones was building the coffin, and which she wore during the next year while the aunt lived there, and the three women wove their own garments and raised their own food and cut the wood they cooked it with. Excusin' what help they had from Jones, who lived with his granddaughter in the abandoned fishing camp with its collapsing roof and rotten porch, against which the rusty scythe which Sutpen was to lend him, make him borrow to cut away the weeds from the door, and at last forced him to use, though not to cut weeds, at least not vegetable weeds, would lean for 2 years, and wore still after the aunt's indignation had swept her back to town to live on stolen garden truck and out of anonymous baskets left on her front steps at night. The three of them, the two daughters, negro and white, and the aunt 12 miles away, watching from her distance as the two daughters watched from theirs, the old demon, the ancient varicose and despairing Faustus, fling his final mane now with the creditor's hand already on his shoulder, running his little country store now for his bread and meat, haggling tediously over nickels and dimes with rapacious and poverty-stricken whites and negroes, who at one time would have galloped for 10 miles in any direction without crossing his own boundary, using out of his meager stock the cheap ribbons and beads and the stale, violently colored candy with which even an old man can seduce a 15-year-old country girl, to ruin the granddaughter of his partner, this Jones, this gangling, malaria-ridden white man whom he had given permission 14 years ago to squat in the abandoned fishing camp with the year-old grandchild. Jones, partner, porter, and clerk, who at the demon's command removed with his own hand, and maybe delivered too from the showcase, the candy beads and ribbons, measured the very cloth from which Judith, who had not been bereaved and did not mourn, helped the granddaughter to fashion a dress to walk past the lounging men in, the side looking in the tongues, until her increasing belly taught her embarrassment, or perhaps fear. Jones, who before 61 had not even been allowed to approach the front of the house, and who during the next 4 years got no nearer than the kitchen door, and that only when he brought the game and fish and vegetables on which the seducer to be's wife and daughter, and Clytie, too, the one remaining servant, Negro, the one who would forbid him to pass the kitchen door with what he brought, depended on to keep life in them, but who now entered the house itself on the quite frequent now afternoons when the demon would suddenly curse the store empty of customers and lock the door and repair to the rear, and in the same tone in which he used to address his orderly or even his house servants when he had them, and in which he doubtless ordered Jones to fetch from the showcase the ribbons and beads and candy, direct Jones to fetch the jug. The two of them, and Jones even sitting now, who in the old days, the old dead Sunday afternoons of monotonous peace, which they spent beneath the scuppernong arbor in the backyard, the demon lying in the hammock while Jones squatted against a post, rising from time to time to pour for the demon from the demijohn and the bucket of spring water which he had fetched from the spring more than a mile away, then squatting again, chortling and chuckling and saying, "Sure, Mr. Tom," each time the demon paused. The two of them drink and turn about from the jug, and the demon not lying down now, nor even sitting, but reaching after the third or second drink, that old man's state of impotent and furious undefeat, in which he would rise, swaying and plunging and shouting for his horse and pistols to ride single-handed into Washington and shoot Lincoln, a year or so too late here, and Sherman both, shouting, "Kill them! Shoot them down like the dogs they are!" And Jones, "Sure, Colonel, sure now," and catching him as he fell and commandeering the first passing wagon to take him to the house and carry him up the front steps and through the paintless formal door beneath its fanlight imported pane by pane from Europe, which Judith held open for him to enter with no change, no alteration in that calm, frozen face which she had worn for 4 years now, and on up the stairs and into the bedroom and put him to bed like a baby and then lie down himself on the floor beside the bed, though not to sleep, since before dawn the man on the bed would stir and groan, and Jones would say, "Here I am, Colonel. It's all right. They ain't whooped us yet, air they?" This Jones, who after the demon rode away with the regiment when the granddaughter was only 18,